to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
I think it's very important to begin to raise the issue of the need for peace negotiations to get out of this mess in Afghanistan.
Gareth Porter joins us to talk about the difficulties of understanding White House policy on Afghanistan. He's an investigative historian and journalist specializing in national security policy. His latest book is The Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam. Gareth Porter, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dori.
This story, and you've worked on it too, about the Karzai family ties to the CIA. What about the significance of this story?
Yeah, this is a story that certainly captured a lot of people's imagination. That is the fact that President Hamid Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, turns out to have been on the CIA's payroll for a number of years. And, you know, the fact that he's well known to be a major figure in the drug industry in Afghanistan is certainly a major part of that story. The fact that the CIA is using Karzai's militia, his private army, as a kind of a counterinsurgency strike force is really a very important part of the story about what the United States is doing in Afghanistan. What I then added to that story is that, in fact, the CIA's hiring of Karzai's brother's private army is only the tip of a much bigger iceberg. And that iceberg is that United States forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan are heavily dependent on the private armies of the warlords to provide particularly security for their fixed bases, their forward operating bases and their other camps, encampments in Afghanistan. What I found in researching this subject is that essentially, the United States has been in bed with the warlords ever since the beginning of the post-Taliban period. And, of course, the United States was supporting the same commanders when they were the leaders of the anti-Taliban movement, the Northern Alliance, in the 2001 war against the Taliban. But even after the Taliban had fled from Kabul, you know, the leadership at least had gone to Pakistan, the United States continued to support these commanders who then became what are known as warlords because they were able to use their armies, essentially armies which were loyal to their commanders and not to any central national government of Afghanistan. They were continuing to pay them off, give them cash and weapons and even communications equipment to provide services to help the CIA teams in Afghanistan try to track down al-Qaeda remnants. But then that simply continued over the next few years. The warlords became essentially the most important allies of the United States in the country. And so instead of really supporting a strong state in Afghanistan, what the United States was doing was essentially having a whole bunch of warlord allies who were on our payroll. And this has then evolved into a situation where the warlords get a payment, not necessarily from the CIA, but from U.S. military forces and from NATO contingents in Afghanistan to provide security by their private armies for protection of these forward operating bases and other bases in the country. And so we really are very dependent on the warlords for continuing to be able to maintain our presence. And so that means the significance of this story really is that the United States is in no position to try to bring about reform of the Karzai administration or of Afghan politics because we're dependent on the very figures who are completely opposed to any reform. Those people want to keep things where they are.
It really does seem like we're getting two very different stories about U.S. policy in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think I understood the question to be the lack of transparency in U.S. policy as to who we're really supporting in Afghanistan, and I think that's absolutely correct. The idea that the United States is at this moment poised to bring about some sort of, you know, new era of reform in Afghanistan by putting pressure on Karzai and somehow, you know, rejiggering the faces who appear in the Afghan ministries or something like that is sheer lunacy. It's totally imaginary. That's not what we're going to be seeing in the near future at all. The fact is that the Obama administration is stuck in a situation where there are no answers, there is no resolution, there's no bullet that can sort of transform this structure, this feudal or even pre-feudal structure of competing warlords of different ethnic groups, different tribes, all of them extremely authoritarian and completely dominated by leaders, not democratic at all. There's no possibility for any democratic development in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. And the idea that you can somehow create a legitimate national government under those circumstances makes no sense whatsoever. So I think that the premise of your question, which is how can American voters understand this policy, is absolutely correct. There is a fundamental disjuncture between the rhetoric of the administration and the reality of what they are actually supporting in Afghanistan, which frustrates the very essence of democratic choice with regard to policy as well as, you know, who to support in this country.
You wrote in your analysis piece for Interpress Service that the CIA's former National Intelligence Officer for the Mideast, Paul Pillar, expressed doubt that the Taliban's ties with al-Qaeda were tighter now than they were before. This, again, getting at the two different stories we're hearing about the region.
Sure. I mean, this is another facet, if you will, of the problem of understanding what's going on in the Obama administration, which is that there are really two dramatically different takes now on the original rationale for the U.S. military presence and effort in Afghanistan. One of these is the explanation that says, you know, there is a threat that al-Qaeda will return to Afghanistan if the Taliban are able to hang on and even get into power in Kabul, because there is a tight alliance between the Taliban leadership and al-Qaeda. And in fact, not just alliance, but in some versions of this argument, it's even argued that they are really merged, that they are virtually one movement, sharing global jihadist objectives and so forth. The other argument, however, which has begun to crop up here and there in leaks to the media and even in the statements by Obama administration officials, including White House spokesman Robert Gibbs, is that there is an important distinction between the Taliban and the al-Qaeda organization, that the Taliban is a nationalist phenomenon, an Afghan phenomenon, that is interested essentially in taking power in Afghanistan, but does not pose a global threat. It is not, you know, an organization that is out to try to carry out terrorism around the globe, as al-Qaeda is. And that implies, of course, that there is not the kind of equivalent or merging of the two organizations as is argued by those who are determined essentially to provide a renewed vigor for the argument for a strong counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan. In fact, an enlarged counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan. And one can discern here at least the desire of President Obama to at least have the option, if he feels it's necessary, to ramp down the U.S. effort, or at least not to increase the U.S. effort. And so these two views of the relationship between Taliban on one hand and al-Qaeda on the other are also the arguments for two different, at least two distinct approaches to policy toward Afghanistan. Now, we still don't know what President Obama has in mind, what he's going to announce. Whether it's next week or the week after that, that's still very closely guarded. And regardless of some of the leaks that have come out saying Obama's already made up his mind, that he's going to give 40,000 or 45,000 or whatever troops to General McChrystal, I think we need to keep our powder dry here and wait and see what the president has in fact decided. I think it's premature at this moment to say that he's made up his mind, even though, you know, certainly there are circumstantial indications that he probably is going to go along with at least some part of the request. But it appears that the president and some of his closest advisors, at least, are sort of shifting away from the idea that we must continue to have a counterinsurgency war such as McChrystal is talking about because of the threat that al-Qaeda is going to return. And so that's why Paul Pillar's answer to this question, which is that no, they are not closer than ever before. In fact, it's the opposite, that there is much less dependence on the part of the Taliban on al-Qaeda's help than there was before 9/11, and indeed even in the aftermath of 9/11, during that final period before the overthrow of the Taliban. And I would also say that there's other indications or other evidence as well that the Taliban is by no means the same as al-Qaeda. They are distinct, that the Taliban has its own interests, that it would be probably willing to make a deal to keep al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan as part of a peace agreement with the United States. And that's why I think it's very important to begin to raise the issue of the need for peace negotiations to get out of this mess in Afghanistan.
Well, I think it's fair to ask where General McChrystal might stand on the use of these warlords.
I think McChrystal is beginning to get an inkling that there's a political problem associated with the status quo of these close ties between the United States and the warlords for security. He's being, for the first time, actually bothered by that. And of course, he was one of the key figures in establishing these ties, because the special forces were certainly in the lead in their close relationships with the warlords, their reliance on the warlords for helping to guard their bases, as well as for intelligence, actually. This is another facet of the story that I didn't get into in my article. But I think he understands that this is problematic, but I don't think that he has any idea of how to get out of that situation, how to change it. Because, as Jake Sherman said, really, if they don't have the renta militias, if you will, of the warlords to protect their bases, they're going to be much more vulnerable. And, you know, it's going to be a long time before they could possibly train and put in the field reliable troops that are not loyal to warlords. And so in the absence of this reliable alternative, and there isn't anything in sight for a considerable period of time, whether it's a year or 2 years, that they are going to continue with these ties with the warlords. Nothing's really going to change. I think that's the bottom line.
And when you use the word militia and you're talking about security, I'm reminded of those long, terrible months of violence in Iraq for the very same reason that America started to rely on its alliance with militias in Iraq.
If you're referring to the continuing suicide bombing and other bombing, in particularly in the capital, this is a phenomenon which clearly the United States military cannot really do much about. It is part of the conflict that really the United States created by overthrowing the Saddam Hussein regime and was never in a position to master or to eliminate. It could only paper it over or try to reduce it through alliances or, you know, agreements with some of the Sunni insurgents who came out of the resistance and agreed to become part of anti-al-Qaeda militias, but only because they were already in essentially in a war or at war with al-Qaeda, and also because they were afraid of the power of the Shia-dominated government and hoped that the United States would somehow help protect them and ally with them against the Shia. The bottom line is, again, that these tensions between sectarian groups, the Sunni and Shia, in this case in Iraq, transcended any possible progress that the United States could make through its military presence. It has never been able to eliminate the power rivalry that is continuing between Sunni and Shia, and the fears and the violence between the two sides that started when the United States overthrew Saddam, and which is going to continue even after the United States withdraws its troops.
And so, again, I'm reminded, though, that death squads developed in Iraq and, you know, tied to these militias that the U.S. was paying.
And the Bush administration, of course, was willing to tolerate a Shia death squad because they were part of an anti-Sunni resistance force, which the United States desperately needed in the 2003-2004 period. That was a period when the United States had no Iraqi military allies to speak of, and was really dependent on the Shia, what it could find in the Shia community, which were essentially the pro-Iranian militias, which were indeed beginning to form death squads by 2004. And the neocons in the administration, Paul Wolfowitz in particular, sort of averted their eyes and said, well, we're going to have to work with these people because that's all we have in the way of allies in the Iraqi political landscape to take on the Sunnis, and we need to have some Iraqi allies there.
We're looking at some individuals who are receiving a large amount of money. We have a Colonel Khan, Security Force Protecting NATO's International Security Assistance Force, the ISAF, $340,000 a month, nearly $1.4 million annually for getting two convoys from Kandahar to Tarin Kot.
That's right. I mean, this is a huge amount of money, you know, in the Afghan context. And, you know, it's part of the buildup of power, maintaining of power, of the warlord structure in Afghanistan. Not suggesting that if the United States, you know, withdrew its contracts with these warlords and other NATO allies withdrew their contracts with the warlords, that it would by any means spell the end of that system. Far from it. I mean, they also have other sources of income, not the least of which is their control over the drug trafficking in Afghanistan, which is, of course, the major segment of the economy. But certainly the U.S. financial support for the warlords gives them another lucrative source of income, and it's well known in the provinces, and it symbolizes the tight relationship between the United States and the warlords, and that's something the warlords have always exploited politically to intimidate everybody else in the provinces where they hold sway. And this, again, goes back to the immediate post-Taliban period, from the beginning of the U.S. paying off of the warlords to provide their services on behalf of the CIA and Special Forces counterterrorism activities in Afghanistan. It's always been the case that the U.S. visible support for the warlords, well-known support for the warlords, has been a major factor in the politics of that country and has caused the population of the country to question U.S. motives and to really be much more alienated from the U.S. and foreign military presence in Afghanistan than would otherwise be the case. But it is part of the reality, part of the warp and woof of this U.S. and NATO effort in Afghanistan, that their association with the warlords is a major part of the reason for popular opposition to foreign military presence.
Well, anyone familiar with the 80s and who would remember the conversations that went on in Congress about the payment of many U.S. black fund dollars to these warlords in Pakistan through Zia and how that destabilized Pakistan. We're still fighting the war, the blowback from that time. So if that's the policy NATO is starting to take on now with America, one has to wonder if they're taking a very long view, let's say, of where this might lead.
Absolutely. I mean, the United States national security state never learns the right lesson from the past. They always learn only the lessons that they can use to justify their continued existence and their continuation of similar policies. And that is certainly the case with regard to Afghanistan. If they learned the right lesson from the past in Afghanistan, it would be that sort of overt militaristic approaches and support for war in the Afghanistan context necessarily, inevitably involves blowback, unforeseen negative consequences, which we will regret in the end. And there's no doubt in my mind that we are reenacting that drama again. We are carrying out policies which, once again, as you've suggested, will have serious blowback in the future, whether it's next year, the year after that, or 5, 10, 15 years in the future. And part of that is going to be that the very warlords who we continue to support will inevitably end up being part of structures which will be carrying out activities which we will find are not in the interest of U.S. security at all, not in the interest of the American people.
Just go over the history of the new Iranian facility, just revealed to the American people anyway, in October at Qom.
The negotiations, which are the result of a proposal from the International Atomic Energy Agency, acting as a kind of go-between between Iran and the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. These negotiations are revolving around a proposal that the IAEA has made that Iran would hand over something like 75 to 80% of its low-enriched uranium, and that this would go to Russia and perhaps to France for reprocessing and would come back in a form that could not be then used for HEU, for highly enriched uranium, but could only be used for the purpose of supporting a reactor specifically for medical isotopes, which is, you know, it's a demonstrated, documented need that Iran has for 20% enriched uranium as opposed to the 3 to 4% enriched uranium which they now have. Now, the United States and other P5 plus 1 members have supported this proposal. They like this proposal because it would take away all of the, not all of, but four-fifths of the low-enriched uranium that Iran has in stock all in one swoop, and thus they would not have even the theoretical basis for high-enriched uranium which could be used to make a bomb. So the P5 plus 1, including the United States, are for this. Iran agreed in principle on October 1st to this this proposal, but made it clear that it would have to be more carefully examined and that the final decision would have to be made later. So the Iranians have now responded officially to the proposal, and they have essentially made a counterproposal which would require that the transmission or the handing over of their low-enriched uranium would take place in a series of tranches or batches, and that it would be matched in time. It would come at the same time that the consortium or the Russian and French companies that enrich or reprocess the low-enriched uranium would deliver the 20% enriched uranium to their reactor in Iran. So there would be a much closer relationship in time between the two sides of the bargain. And this apparently has been denounced by the P5 plus 1, including the United States, as unacceptable. And so now the entire negotiation over that deal is very much in question. And my only comment about that is that I think it was really never very realistic to expect Iran to accept a deal which really gave up its major bargaining leverage and really got very little in return for that. And I think the Iranians are aware that the stock of low-enriched uranium, which they have acquired, which they're continuing to add to, albeit very slowly, is in fact their sole basis for bargaining leverage with the United States and its allies. And I think it's not going to give that up so easily. It's going to hold on to it, pending a much broader bargain, at the very least. So that's my take on the bargain.
And in your piece, you go over the long list of instances where the Bush administration threatened to attack Iran. And you're citing that as sort of an explanation for some of the headlines we've seen all this time about Iran's response.
Now, I think this is very important to try to reconstruct the sequence of events and how they affected Iranian decision-making, specifically on the question of an additional enrichment facility. We know that there was a relationship between this enrichment facility at Qom, which the Iranians informed the IAEA of in September 21st, and the previous threats to attack the Iranian nuclear facilities by the Bush administration, particularly in late 2006, early 2007. This was really the high point of the threat of an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities by the Bush administration. And it reached its zenith, its high point, in February, March 2007, when the Bush administration leaked to the news media that it was about to send a third naval task group to the Persian Gulf to join the two existing task groups. It had already added to one task group in January. It doubled the U.S. naval and air presence in the Persian Gulf the previous month and was announcing to the press that it was going to then add yet a third naval task group. And this would have duplicated the U.S. military presence in the region of Iran at the time of the U.S. attack on Iraq in March of 2003. And it was announced very clearly as a signal to Iran that the United States really meant business. And then in March of 2007, the Bush administration carried out a naval exercise in the Persian Gulf involving the two existing naval task groups with about 100 aircraft and some two dozen aircraft and warships. So it was the largest combined naval and air exercise since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That was clearly an effort to send a message to Iraq that the United States was getting closer to a possible attack on Iran. And that was then immediately followed within 3 or 4 days by an Iranian announcement to the IAEA that it was withdrawing from its commitment to provide design information on any new nuclear facility before any construction on the facility began. And it was then explained by a leading political figure in Iran, aligned with the conservative government of President Ahmadinejad, that the reason for this was that the Iranians now believed that any design information provided would be misused, as he said, by the United States and Israel. So they were tying it directly to the threat from the Bush administration. So I think that this, along with the indications that there had not been any construction on the GUM facility during 2007, prior to the National Intelligence Estimate that came out in November of 2007, to indicate to U.S. intelligence that there was evidence of a covert nuclear facility there, that leads me to believe with a great deal of confidence that it was only later that the actual construction on the GUM facility began, and that it was, in fact, the result of the Iranian perception of threat from the Bush administration. Now, I think that that perception of threat, by the way, has receded, and I think that helps to account for the fact that Iran was then willing to inform the IAEA of the existence of the facility last month, and indeed to invite the IAEA to come and inspect it, and of course to begin the process of regular IAEA surveillance of the facility.
One has to finally wonder how threats of military force against a country yet to develop a nuclear weapon protects security in the region or any civilian populations anywhere, and yet we're seeing it again in the form of the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, neoconservatives who are regrouping to make that very argument. I think it was Bolton who said, you know, Israel or the U.S. should nuke Iran.
Well, it goes without saying that John Bolton and people of his ilk do not represent the interests of the American people in any way, shape, or form. I mean, they represent a very narrow special interest which has to do with Israel as well as with the most extreme elements in the U.S. military who are in favor of the military option on Iran. And this is recognized by the vast majority of the U.S. military and particularly the high-level leadership of the U.S. military who have been opposed, as I think most people are well aware, strongly opposed to any use of military force against Iran with regard to the nuclear facilities, because this would inevitably cause a region-wide conflict, a conflagration in which the U.S. military would be among the obvious targets and would suffer potentially very grievous damage. And particularly, of course, it's the U.S. naval presence in the Persian Gulf, which would stand to be the most vulnerable in any regional war that would be provoked by an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities. So again, I just want to emphasize that these people are so far from representing any serious effort to promote the interests of the American people or even of the U.S. national security state. I mean, they are not even in line with the interests of the U.S. national security state. They're so far out of the mainstream.
Veteran investigative historian and journalist Gareth Porter. And we'll air the rest of our interview with him next time as we talk more about America's national security state. And you can read Gareth Porter's work at Interpress Service News or at the new blog of Interpress journalists at Huffington Post, It's Crossover Dreams. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut, talknationradio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.